over the past 2 to 3 years. Is this voter turnout desirable? Well, in other countries, this level is something acceptable, if not desirable. But for the Islamic Republic of Iran, no, it is not desirable. We should not content ourselves with this turnout rate and need to increase it for the next elections.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of the program where we'll go over some news headlines. President hails election turnout as blow to opponents of Iran. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has appreciated the Iranian people for their massive turnout in the Friday elections to choose members of parliament as well as the assembly of experts, saying that the turnout was a blow to opponents of the country. Irna writes, Raisi said in his message that the ill-wishers of the country did all they could to discourage people from voting, but the people's participation, filled with faith and hope, was a big no to the inhumane front of arrogance and foiled their insincere plan. Iranians rebuff electoral boycott calls. Before the voting day had even arrived in Iran, Western media outlets became awash with reports and analyses predicting that Iranians would not turn up at the polling stations this year. Tehran Times writes, headlines such as Iran braces for low election turnout, Iranians expected to shun elections, and low turnout and boycott expected were how the stenographers of politicians in the West decided to speak of Iran's March 1st elections. However, none of these renowned media outlets managed to come up with substantial data or polling information to support their claims. Iran parliamentary elections likely to go to runoff. With 4,000 out of 5,000 ballot boxes in Tehran counted, some of the candidates seem to have to compete in a runoff, as there were no clear winners among them, officials say. Quoting from Governor of Tehran Province, Alireza Fakhari, Iran Front Page writes, this law says any candidate who wins at least 20% of the valid votes can enter parliament in the first round. But if they fail to garner at least 20% of the ballots, they will probably go to a second round. Over 250,000 forces ensure security of elections, official says. Iranian Interior Ministry's Deputy for Security Affairs, Majid Mirahmadi, said on Friday, over 250,000 forces have been tasked with ensuring the security of elections and guarding the polling sites. Shahr Daily writes, Mirahmadi said on Friday morning that long queues of voters have been formed at many polling stations across the country, describing it as a major epic. He noted that full security prevails at all polling stations, thanks to the efforts by the security and intelligence organizations. Venezuela congratulates Iran on elections, commends its people's will. Venezuela's foreign minister has congratulated Iran and its people on their elections and their dedications to combating foreign plots. Al-Mayadeen writes, Venezuela has congratulated Iran in celebration of its elections, praising the exercise as a show of democracy. In a post on X, the Venezuelan Minister of Foreign Affairs said the President Nicolas Maduro and the government of Venezuela congratulate the people and the government of the sister Islamic Republic of Iran for the celebration of the democratic exercise carried out in the 12th elections for the Consultative Assembly or Majlis and the 6th elections for the Assembly of Experts this March 1st, 2024 in the Iranian territory. Thank you for joining us in this section. Let's go back to the main narrative.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
The elections were a big slap to those who tried to keep the polling booths empty of voters, that is, the sworn enemies of the Iranian nation. On contrary, people came out in large numbers to exercise their voting rights, thwarting the plots hatched by troublemongers and naysayers. They left no stone unturned since 2021 to create hopelessness among Iranians. But the fact that the turnout matched that of the 2020 parliamentary elections shows that enemy plots failed miserably.
I dare say that the pressure from outside to discourage people was unprecedented this time. I dare say that the sanctions and economic pressure were also meant to make people discontent before the elections. At the same time, Western media outlets cast doubt on the elections. They tried to say that the elections were meaningless with no impact on the future of the people. That said, I have to admit that economic problems acted negatively. Some people might have lost their faith in the efficiency and efficacy of the parliament as a body capable of resolving the economic problems.
Western media showed open hostility in these elections, not towards the candidates and their policies, and not towards the absence of certain candidates, but towards the very elections. Even before the votes were cast, they issued premature verdicts, with some even predicting less than 10% turnout and some suggesting that the Iranian system was rotting. In other words, they weren't seeking to engage in journalism, but were striving to graft a script for Iran's elections and then cover it through their distorting lenses.
Do you think the call for the boycott of elections worked?
Foreigners were seeking to undermine the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic of Iran by calling on people to boycott elections. But people instead said a big no to them. Each ballot was in fact a bullet shot at this boycott scheme. As for the opposition groups outside the country, they use anything to get funds. By ignoring many facts, they want to offer a picture of the country which, although has nothing to do with reality, can appease their paymasters.
While there are still some countries in the region who have no idea about election, the U.S. and its minions are trying to cast doubt on the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic by begging the question, by linking the turnout rate to whatever they wish. Even before the polls opened, they termed the elections a sham, urging people not to vote. At the same time, some Western media outlets tried to manipulate their audiences by showing a few half-empty polling stations out of 60,000 of them across the country. Linking turnout with the legitimacy of the entire political system is not only absurd but hypocritical. Low or lukewarm turnout has been a common phenomenon in other countries, including in the West. Over the last 2 years, such trends have been widely reported in the German, French, and British media, especially in the context of elections of secondary importance. But unlike the Iranian case, the legitimacy of the German, French, and British governments has never been called into question.
Given the relatively low turnout, do you think that the ruling system is faced with a legitimation crisis?
Look, we shouldn't immediately connect whatever happens in society to the legitimation crisis. You know, for months, nationwide protests were held across France, but no one interpreted it as the legitimation crisis of the French political system. There is no logical relationship between these two. You might infer from low turnout that there is, for example, some sort of discontent in society at the performance of, for example, the government. But it's just jumping to conclusion if we connect any political or social development to the legitimation crisis.
Voter turnout is not a fixed, stable phenomenon. It fluctuates from time to time, and it's not going to be the ultimate criterion for the legitimacy of a ruling system, as no single factor determines voter turnout. Rather, a complex mix of individual, social, and political factors have an influence on it. For example, older, more educated, and higher income-earning people are generally more likely to vote than younger, less educated people and people with lower incomes.
After nearly 40 elections, people may not take elections as serious as before. Some might feel that it's okay if they do not go to the polls because there are many other people who go, or because they think there are many other elections in the future that they can take part in. Moreover, unlike some other countries in the world, going to the polls is not obligatory in our country. In other countries with higher voter turnout, strict rules, regulations, and fines may act as a carrot for the people to vote. But we do not agree with this method. We believe that people's political participation should be of their own volition. You cannot force them to take part in an election if they don't want to.
Mr. Imani made a noteworthy point concerning the voter turnout.
Please note that on average, the voter turnout in Iran has been around 60%. It means that 40% of people never go to the polls under no circumstances. This is true about the elections held 10, 20, or 30 years ago. Was there any legitimation crisis 30 years ago? I don't think so.
Linking voter turnout to the legitimacy of a political system is not just jumping into conclusion, but altering the reality for mischievous purposes.
Look, as for the self-proclaimed champions of democracy, such as the US, the UK, France, and the like, if you take a look at their voter turnout, it's usually below 50%. And that's despite all these strict rules, regulations, fines, and sometimes punishments. So by their standards, we are still in a satisfactory state, although we were better in the early years after the revolution. As a republic, we like to have higher voter turnout because we believe it would be to the benefit of the country, because, for example, it will help us to have the upper hand in the international arena. Yet, we firmly believe that this political participation should be voluntary, unlike some other countries such as Turkey, France, and the United States.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979, 12 parliamentary elections have been held in the country. The ruling system has always encouraged the public to go to the polls, to use their rights to vote and their rights to self-determination. And as long as they do so, the real winners will be the Iranian people.
People want their votes to be seen. They don't just want to go to the polls for its own sake, but they vote so as to be heard. They want their opinions and concerns to be taken into serious considerations, whether through the ballot boxes or other ways. They want their representatives to be accessible and responsible, and at the same time, adherent to their election promises.
While hostile media outlets zeroed in on the turnout rate, which is comparatively on par with the rest of the world, this round of elections was outstanding in some other regards. For example, this time, voters' identification processes was done electronically, and therefore the voters didn't have to form endless queues. This year, the candidates across the country were provided with nearly 200 TV channels, an equal opportunity for the candidates. This was especially suitable for lesser-known candidates and those who did not have enough budget for campaigning expenses. Also, printing posters, in addition to the unnecessary costs, caused a lot of wastage every year. This year, however, it was all avoided with free online and on-air platforms.
This time, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, the IRIB, provided the candidates across the country with nearly 200 channels. This caused the face of the city to remain almost unchanged in the run-up to the elections. You could rarely see posters, banners, and flyers advertising the candidates. We had to explain this point to foreign reporters who had come to Iran expecting something else. I would like to add that these TV channels and social media platforms were very influential in shaping public opinion.
But that's not all. This year also, transparency in election campaigns reached a new high. Have we had anything new in this round of parliamentary elections?
البته یه تفاوت‌های این انتخابات
There were some changes in this round of elections, some good, some in need of reconsideration. I think the time for the election campaign needs to be extended. Many candidates need more than 2 weeks to introduce themselves to their electorate. This limited time acts to the benefit of more famous candidates. On the other hand, the law transparency enforced this year was about the candidates' campaign budget was a good point for this round. The vetting process, I think, still needs improvement, although, in my opinion, the Garden Council's conduct was much better this year in comparison to the past.
Moreover, the elections were held in complete security. Ensuring security for 59,000 voting stations is easier said than done, especially in the Middle East, a region threatened by terrorist groups and their Western paymasters.
Could you tell us about some of the positive aspects of this round of elections?
The security of the elections was also a priority, underlined by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. While the enemies were lurking to undermine the security of the elections were held the best possible way, despite its extreme difficulty. Likewise, the authorities did their best to have fair elections. There was a head-to-head competition among all political groups to enter the decision-making system. I mean, the parliament. Generally speaking, I can say that we had clean elections, free of fraud, ballot rigging, and smear campaigns. Political groups were all allowed to field their candidates. Different lists of candidates support this claim.
The results of this year's elections were also of great significance. It was a reminder that no one should take victory for granted, no matter how big, famous, or influential they might be. In a fair and free election, the result is no way a foregone conclusion.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again same times to see what else is on. Till next time, take care.
In the limelight.
The British government will announce a plan to increase gas power capacity by providing extra certainty to investors that plants have a long-term future, even as Britain moves away from fossil fuels. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak risks further criticism from Green campaigners after throwing his weight behind the building of new gas-fired power stations, saying he will not gamble with our energy security. The government will announce a plan to increase gas power capacity by providing extra certainty to investors that plants have a long-term future, even as Britain moves away from fossil fuels. Ministers said it represented a common-sense decision to ensure power supplies kept flowing during the transition to net zero. They argued that gas plants were a safe and reliable source of energy when weather conditions did not power wind and solar farms. The government claimed that the move would not impact net zero targets. However, critics are likely to see it as a backward step in the wider push to decarbonise Britain's power network through renewable energy projects. Some big energy firms have deserted the gas industry in recent years to focus on renewable energies, which have a more certain future. Last year, gas accounted for 32% of Great Britain's electricity generation, ahead of 29% from wind power and 14% from nuclear power. The last remaining coal-burning plant at Radcliffe on Soar in Nottinghamshire is due to close in September. Renewable industry backers argued investment in battery projects which can store electricity when weather conditions are unfavourable is vital to make the system more reliable. The Energy Secretary, Claire Coutinho, is expected to set out a strategy for gas at a speech at the think tank Chatham House in central London in the coming days. She will say, without gas backing up renewables, we face the genuine prospect of blackouts. Other countries in recent years have been so threatened by supply constraints that they have been forced back to coal. Claire Coutinho, the Energy Secretary, added, there are no easy solutions in energy, only trade-offs. If countries are forced to choose between clean energy and keeping citizens safe and warm, believe me, they'll choose to keep the lights on. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. Jess Ralston, an energy analyst at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit think tank, says the UK Secretary of State suggesting that if Britons cannot control energy prices, then they are not secure as a country, while announcing new gas power stations has a real irony about it. Jess Ralston added, anyone paying an energy bill in the past 2 years knows that the United Kingdom doesn't control the price we pay for gas, that international markets decide. Energy security has shot up the political agenda since Russia cut off gas exports to Europe after the start of war with Ukraine in 2022. European sanctions against Moscow have left countries scrambling to secure new supplies of energy. And household bills have soared. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak says we need to reach our 2035 goal in a sustainable way that doesn't leave people without energy on a cloudy, windless day. I will not gamble with our energy security. The Prime Minister's intervention appears to be his latest effort to win votes by pushing back on green policies. The switch to green power has also become a contentious political point, with the Conservatives pledging to decarbonise power generation by 2035 and Labour by 2030. Both political parties envisage gas-fired plants will play a small part in providing backup power supplies even after those dates, as Britain prepares for a surge in electricity demand despite recent delays to renewable energy and nuclear projects. The Shadow Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, said, of course we need to replace retiring gas-fired stations as part of a decarbonised power system, which will include carbon capture and hydrogen playing a limited backup role in the system. But he said, the reason the Tories cannot deliver the lower bills and energy security we need is that they're specialists in failure when it comes to our clean energy future, persisting with a ludicrous ban on onshore wind, bungling the offshore wind auctions and failing on energy efficiency. Juliet Phillips of the climate think tank E3G says, due to policy failures over the last parliament, the government has missed opportunities to build out the full offshore wind pipeline to make gains in energy efficiency or address clunky network connection times, all factors that mean new gas plants have been announced. Britain's Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho plans to claim that the laws ensuring new build plants are net zero ready will be broadened to encompass hydrogen, allowing gas plants to switch to a new fuel source. Power plants are already due to command record prices to keep the lights on after an auction recently. Rules will also be updated around the capacity market, which sets prices for payments to electricity generators to incentivize gas plant operators. Ministers do not now plan to introduce lower emission limits in the market for new built and refurbished executive plants until 2026 at the earliest. However, one chief of gas plant operators said the changes were unlikely to trigger a new wave of plants. They said, in reality, we can keep updating plants which are nearing the end of their lives at relatively low cost. Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho's speech coincides with a second consultation on review of electricity market arrangements, a set of wide-ranging changes. It is expected to propose zonal pricing, which will allow renewable energy developers to charge higher rates if they build wind and solar farms close to cities, where demand is greater. Separately, the industry regulator Ofgem said on Monday 11th of March it was concerned that costs linked to net zero could disproportionately hit lower income consumers.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The dawns of the month of Ramadan should not be missed. The annual Ramadan Quranic meeting, April 30th, 2019. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I sincerely thank the dear brothers, and I've really benefited from your recitation today. It is a very good, beautiful, and meaningful meeting with diverse and mellifluous recitations, and I thank God for this. When we see that each year the signs of progress in reciting the Holy Quran are visible among our youth and our people, this makes me very happy, and I thank God for this. Thanks to these good recitations, today's meeting was very meaningful, significant, and delightful, particularly because of the good point that our talented and eloquent presenter raised regarding the offering of these recitations and what was achieved in this meeting to the pure souls of the martyrs who were buried in Tehran recently. Reciting the Holy Quran in a good voice and tone and by observing the requirements and conventions of recitation is an introduction to the entrance of Quranic concept into hearts. However, if we merely benefit from this aspect of the Holy Quran, and if we only look at it as an act of recitation and beautiful singing, we will surely be demoted from this lofty rank and position.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The purpose of all this emphasis on reciting the Holy Quran in a good voice, in a beautiful tone, and by observing the requirements is that Quranic concepts influence hearts, that we establish a close relationship with the Holy Quran, and that we take a Quranic mold and color. If this is the goal, then it has certain requirements and conventions. The first convention is that the reciter of the Holy Quran should recite the book by believing in the Holy Quran and the concepts that he is reciting. If we do not know what we are reading, if we do not understand the concepts, and if it does not influence us in a deep way, then our recitation will exert little influence on others and on us. This is the first condition. I request that the Honorable Qura, Quranic experts and reciters of the Holy Quran, pay attention to this point. First, they should review in their minds the ayahs that they want to recite. They should deliberate on them and truly absorb the depth of these concepts in their hearts and their belief.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we started explanation of Surah Muzammil, the number 73 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran, and today we complete it. It has 20 ayahs and revealed in Mecca in the early days of the Prophet's universal mission of Islam. It opens by addressing him as Muzammil, Odi, enwrapped in a cloak or sheet. This epithet means the one renouncing the vanities of the world, or separating himself from all trifle matters for the purpose of meditation, which indicates the prophet's preparedness to receive the divine commandments to guide mankind. The surah describes how God relaxed the early regime of devotion first decreed to the prophet and prepared him for the weighty message of divine revelation. The prophet is urged to be patient against the enemies and is informed in Ayah 10 of the punishment that awaits the disbelievers in hell. Ayah 15 refers to the punishment that befell Egyptian tyrant, the Pharaoh, while alive, thereby drowning him in the sea. According to a hadith from the Prophet, whoever regularly recites Surah Muzzammil will not face hardships in this world and in the hereafter. We start from where we left you last Friday and invite you to listen to Ayahs 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14.
واصبر على ما يقولون واهجرهم هجرا جميلا وذرني والمكذبين أولي النعمة ومهلهم قليلا إن لدينا أنكالا وجحيما وطعاما ذا غصة وعذابا أليما يوم ترجف الأرض والجبال وكانت الجبال كثيبا مهيلا.
And be patient over what they say and keep away from them in a grateful manner. And leave me to deal with the deniers, the opulent, and give them a little respite. Indeed, with us are heavy fetters and a fierce fire, and a food that chokes those who gulp it, and a painful punishment prepared for the day when the earth and the mountains will quake, and the mountains will be like dunes of shifting sand. Might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the midnight vigil is very effective in self-building through sincere worship, since it is the power of prayers and reflection on the flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom of the Noble Quran that provides us the clarity of vision to properly carry our daytime duties with reliance upon God alone, rather than trusting mortals, however powerful, or fearing their malice. In the ayahs that we recited to you now, God tells the Prophet of Islam, and through him all Muslims, to be patient and tolerant in the face of those who ridicule. The best way is to keep away from them at times in a graceful manner in order to avoid their evil. Keeping away from opponents, however, does not mean not to fulfill our obligations and duties in society, which should be as firm as resolve on the battlefields to decisively defeat the enemy, but lenient at the negotiating table to politely convey the truth to convince the other side. In other words, the Prophet and the believers are like a gardener tolerating the strings of thorns in order to pick up flowers. As Ayah 11 says, the matter of the obstinate deniers of truth, most of whom are opulent persons and hence arrogant, should be left to God Almighty, who gives them respite to repent and reform. But if they continue to indulge in their sinful ways, as the next ayah warns, terrible punishment shall be their fate. The disbelievers and unrepentant sinners are warned of the fetters of hell and its fierce fire, as well as indelible food that choke the throat. In contrast to the delicious food they had enjoyed in the world and indulged in the pleasures of the flesh, the severity of such torments is known to no one but God Almighty. The inmate of hell shall be fed from the tree of Zaqqum, a bitter and poisonous plant of a foul smell. On the day of resurrection, the seemingly mighty mountains shall disintegrate and turn into soft sand in which feet sink. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, the best way to confront insults and ridicule is to be patient and ignore them instead of behaving in the same irrational way towards opponents. Number two, the true believer should act in civilized way by putting trust in God without paying attention to the nonsense uttered by the insulters. And number three, wealth and opulence often mislead many possessors to drift away from religion, ridicule believers, and indulge in cardinal sins, as history bears witness. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 15, 16, 17, 18 and 19 of the same surah.
Inna arsalna ilaykum rasulan shahidan alaykum kama arsalna ila fir'aun rasula. فَعَصَى فِرْعَوْنُ الرَّسُولَ فَأَخَذْنَاهُ أَخْذًا وَبِيلًا فَكَيْفَ تَتَّقُونَ إِن كَفَرْتُمْ يَوْمًا يَجْعَلُ الْوِلْدَانَ شِيبًا السَّمَاءُ مُنْفَطِرٌ بِهِ كَانَ وَعْدُهُ مَفْعُولًا إن هذه تذكرة فمن شاء اتخذ إلى ربه سبيلا.
Indeed, we have sent to you a prophet to be a witness to you, just as we sent a prophet to Pharaoh. But Pharaoh disobeyed the prophet, Moses, so we seized him with a terrible seizing. So, if you disbelieve, how will you avoid the day which will make children white-headed, and wherein the sky will be rent apart? His promise is bound to be fulfilled. This is indeed a reminder, so let anyone who wishes take the way toward his Lord. These ayahs begin by drawing a comparison between the Prophet of Islam, who was raised as a witness over mankind, with Prophet Moses, who was sent to guide the Egyptian Pharaoh. It is a warning to the polytheist to heed the terrible fate that befell Pharaoh for rejecting Prophet Moses' message of monotheism and the path of truth. Those who persist in unbelief and sins are posed the question, what makes you think that your abominable sins and disbelief will keep you safe from divine wrath that makes the children grow old? The torments inflicted upon the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners on the day of resurrection shall be so severe, horrible, and harsh that the hairs of children will turn white due to the terrible shock. On that day, in fulfillment of divine promise, the sky shall rent asunder to the extent that even the huge celestial bodies and planets shall be shattered by the terrible happenings. So, how could mankind, which is weak and vulnerable by nature, shall face such incidents? So choose the right path that leads to the bounties of the all-merciful Lord before death ends the transient life of the mortal world. And know that the Almighty Creator, who has endowed human beings with gift of the intellect, wants them to properly recognize the truth and choose it out of the free will, rather than imposing it upon them. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, prophets are witness to the deeds of the nations they have been sent to guide, while Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the infallible Imams, are witness over all our deeds. Number two, The accounts of the past generations are lessons to be heeded by the next and future generations so as not to repeat the same blunders. Number 3. There is no way of escape for the faithless from Allah's punishment on the Day of Resurrection. And number 4. The Almighty Creator has bestowed mankind the best of creation with the gifts of the intellect, the speech, and free will to choose the truth from firm conviction. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment that marks the end of Surah Muzammil, here is the last ayah, that is number 20.
إِنَّ رَبَّكَ يَعْلَمُ أَنَّكَ تَقُومُ أَدْنَى مِنْ ثُلُثَيِ اللَّيْلِ وَنِصْفَهُ وَثُلُثَهُ وَطَائِفَةٌ مِنَ الَّذِينَ مَعَكَ وَاللَّهُ يُقَدِّرُ اللَّيْلَ وَالنَّهَارَ عَلِمَ أَنْ لَنْ تُحْصُوهُ فَتَابَ عَلَيْكُمْ فَاقْرَؤُوا مَا تَيَسَّرَ مِنَ الْقُرْآنِ عَلِمَ أَنْ سَيَكُونُ مِنْكُمْ مَرْضَى وَآخَرُونَ يَضْرِبُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ يَبْتَغُونَ مِنْ فَضْلِ اللَّهِ وَآخَرُونَ يُقَاتِلُونَ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ فَاقْرَؤُوا مَا تَيَسَّرَ مِنْهُ وَأَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَأَقْرِضُوا اللَّهَ قَرْضًا حَسَنًا وَمَا تُقَدِّمُوا لِأَنفُسِكُم مِّنْ خَيْرٍ تَجِدُوهُ عِندَ اللَّهِ هُوَ خَيْرًا وَأَعْظَمَ أَجْرًا وَاسْتَغْفِرُوا اللَّهَ إِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَّحِيمٌ.
Indeed, your Lord knows that you stand vigil nearly 2/3 of the night, or a half or third of it, along with a group of those who are with you. Allah measures the night and the day. He knows that you cannot calculate it exactly, so He was lenient toward you. So recite as much of the Quran as is feasible. He knows that some of you will be sick, while others will travel in the land seeking Allah's grace, and yet others will fight in the way of Allah. So recite as much of it as is feasible, and maintain the prayer and pay the zakat and lend Allah a good loan. Whatever good you send ahead for your souls, you will find it with Allah in a form that is better and greater with respect to reward. And plead to Allah for forgiveness. Indeed, Allah is all-forgiving, all-merciful. This ayah describes some of the characteristics of the true believers. It starts by emphasizing, or more properly re-emphasizing, the night vigil for performance of the non-obligatory post-midnight tahajjud prayer and recitation of the Noble Quran with contemplation, as we said last week while explaining the first ayah of Surah Muzammil. Thus, the first and last ayahs of this surah, if studied together, make it clear that though the tahajjud prayer is highly recommended, it is not obligatory, yet its rewards are many. The phrase, along with a group of those who are with you, refers to the Prophet's cousin, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, and to the loyal companion, Abu Zar Ghifari. The ayah endorses traveling and fighting for just cause. It stresses the punctual performance of the ritual prayer and calls on believers to pay the zakat from surplus income to the poor people, help them with interest-free loans, and spend for good causes by calling such a practice lend Allah a good loan, which includes spending for good causes. It adds that whatever good one does is solely for his or her soul and will be compensated by Allah much more than mere reward. It concludes with the commandment to plead the All-Merciful Creator for forgiveness, saying, Allah is all-forgiving. The ayah teaches the following points. Number one, Islam is the comprehensive religion, which besides regulating the ritual prayers, commands resolving of social issues by helping the poor and for spending in the way of Allah without being despondent of divine mercy. And number two, religious orders are in compliance with an individual's condition, and all good deeds, whether they require travel or fighting for a just cause, entail abundant rewards from Allah, who forgives those who repent. Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
An annual meeting of Quran reciters and memorizers with the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Every year on the first day of the holy month of Ramadan, leader of the Islamic Revolution receives top reciters of the Holy Quran to stress the importance of this very holy book in the lives of Muslims.
In the meeting, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the recitation of the Quran as a sacred art, while underlining that the primary objective of this very valuable skill should be to convey the meaning and message of the Quran to the public and society and create the ground for contemplation of the Holy Scripture. Elsewhere in his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei expressed his satisfaction with the abundant number of young Quran reciters in the country, viewing their increase as a blessing of the Islamic Revolution. Meanwhile, referring to the crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza, the leader pointed out that the peak of resilience that is being witnessed in Gaza presently stems from a profound familiarity with and adherence to the teachings of the Quran. Before the meeting, young and experienced reciters and memorizers were very much excited to listen and take a glimpse of the leader.
I am very much excited to recite some verses of the Holy Quran in the presence of the leader. But this is a great opportunity for me to see the leader.
This is the third time I have the honor of attending such a great event. Today I am going to have supplications to recite about the holy month of Ramadan.
Other reciters were worried about the people of Gaza who are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign.
The month of Ramadan is the month of mercy and blessing. I do believe that during this month, the Zionist regime will face a big defeat.
At the end of the ceremony, the Quran reciters and memorizers held congregational prayers led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution and broke their fast together. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran, Russia, and China have conducted the main phase of a joint naval drill dubbed Maritime Security Belt 2024. After arriving at the northern part of the Indian Ocean, the vessels of the three countries practiced different operations. The joint drills took place in 17,000 square kilometers of water in a region that is an internationally crucial hub for energy and trade traffic. The first phase of the naval drills included live firing at designated surface targets in the Sea of Oman. Various vessels and fast attack crafts from the IRGC were also involved in the exercise. The vessels were armed with the state-of-the-art homegrown advanced weapons. The next phase included the Photo X exercise and offensive formations. The helicopters of the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy and the IRGC monitored the region in all stages of the exercise. Iran's Navy commander hailed the exercise as a successful endeavor to improve maritime cooperation of the contributing countries. The commander also said that Iran expects the drills to expand in the future.
This year, as we expected, regarding the types of vessels participating in the exercise, both China and Russia have increased the variety as well as tonnage of the vessels. So hopefully, we expect more countries to join the drills in the future, especially regional states.
Admiral Irani also stated that regional nations have the capacity to confront piracy and terrorism by enhancing cooperation. The exercises are the latest in joint drills by Iran, China, and Russia. Iran says regional countries are most welcome to take part in the drills that are going to take place in the future. The Islamic Republic has time and again stressed that regional countries are the ones that are truly in charge of establishing security in the region. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
On the first day of the holy month of Ramadan in Nigeria, the Islamic movement held a rally through the streets of the capital, Abuja, in a peaceful protest against the massacre of innocent civilians in Gaza. The protest march took the demonstrators to the gate of the United States Embassy, where they sat down and submitted a letter of protest condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza and U.S. involvement in the killing of innocent Palestinians.
America is one of the major party in this killing of innocent female and children in Gaza. Since October 7th to date, they have killed more than 31,000 innocent people, majorly female and children in Gaza.
The demonstrators blame the United States and British governments for using their influence to block a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. They said every decent government has condemned the Israeli terror attacks on the Palestinians, but the US government has continued to support the mass murder of innocent Palestinians.
They are killing female and children. They are imposing starvation on innocent female and children. Babies have been seen under rubble, crying inside blood. We see a lot of fathers carrying a lifeless body of their children killed by Israelis. Anybody that has concern for humanity should come out today on the street and show his solidarity with Palestinians.
The demonstrators burned the U.S. and Israeli flags as they slammed Tel Aviv's regime impunity and the silence of the international community.
Many Muslims in Nigeria believe that Israel's continuous killing of Palestinians in Gaza on the eve of the holy month of Ramadan is a clear proof of the regime's disrespect for Islamic sanctities. The protesters here are urging world leaders to pressure Israel to end the massacre in Gaza. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Britons treat their National Health Service, better known as the NHS, with an almost religious reverence.
Who grew up using the NHS from the cradle to the grave, free of a point of use, and that has tremendous significance for our lives.
But today, this eternal source of national pride is under increased scrutiny, with new figures showing more than 120,000 people died last year in England alone from delays in life-saving treatment. The NHS is a state-funded healthcare system founded in 1948. Back then, it cost around $20 billion in today's money to run. Last year, the government spent more than $181 billion. Despite that, more than 7 million people are now on the waiting list in England alone. That's nearly 12% of the population having to wait at least 52 weeks for a health consultation.
our politicians aren't really serving the public interest. They are serving a neoliberal agenda, which is to transfer the country's natural assets and wealth to overseas corporations like United Health of America and other big multinationals.
The government has promised to cut the long queues, but has made little progress. The situation is no better in the rest of the kingdom. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, 1 in 80 people, and in Wales, 1 in 20 are having to wait more than a year for treatment. There's also the energy costs and inflation that has reduced the value of the NHS budget, meaning it now has to do more with significantly less. Add to the mix a shortage of staff, which means more pressure on exhausted employees.